7.
This is K2KEY. A friend of mine called me. He says he bought one about a couple of years ago because he works for a company that does maintenance of broadcast CATV, you know, CATV systems. They do, I don't know, this cable business and all. And so they wanted an instrument, a spectrum analyzer that will go to 2.7 gig and is fairly rugged, runs off batteries and everything, and, you know, very reasonably priced, and works, he says, excellent, phenomenal. It is made by a company called Instek, I-N-S-T-E-K, I-N-S-T-E-K. So they're very reasonably priced, Dick, today, if you want to, you know, have a really a complete instrument. And for and it's, this Instek is actually designed for exactly what he wants to do, to check transmitters, small transmitters, and cable systems, and anything that has to do with RF components manufacturing, actually. Over.
Another good piece of information. Looks like a lot of these things are coming along. Wesley, N2XJN, go right ahead with your comment.
Yeah, there was a good piece of information about the Instek. Actually, what I find out is all of the Chinese stuff, I usually tend to think about it as a cheap crap. And I'm wrong. I've got, everything that I've got was used good quality laboratory equipment. But as far as the frequency counter, I went for the Chinese stuff, actually the Korean one, and that is, what is that? Vicor, V-I-C-T-O-R, VC-3165, high resolution counter. And when I've got this one, I found there is something wrong about it. It was showing me the wrong frequency. So I called the guy. Actually, I didn't call, I sent a message. And this guy actually called me in the middle of the night time, and he said he already sent another one. The manual order was almost done, so there was a poor one. And then I find out by playing with it that they have a special way of setting that, and it will show very much correct frequency. So my understanding, I have two of them. So one is for free, and one is actually that I paid for, $65. Now, amazing accuracy. Better than Tektronix's oscilloscope that I have in here, or at least the same. And as far as the Instek, they actually have very good quality stuff, so I believe they're going to create a great competition. What is going right now with the stuff, and I went through hundreds, maybe thousands of different kind of devices, because I'm shopping for the best for the lowest price, and that's what I mostly do. What I find out is that while the economy in the United States get into the trouble, and economies of the world start to follow, all of this Asian stuff is becoming better and better. That means they have a problem to sell it, so in order to sell, they have to master the certain standards. I wonder what's going to happen, because with this kind of prices, soon we will have everything Chinese, which I already miss the American standard. When something says made in America, for me is something that I am more likely to buy, even if it's old, than it's made in China. Back to you guys.
Yeah, there are good and bad brand names almost everywhere. Most of us have fallen in love with Hewlett Packard / Agilent over the years, because They've got an extremely high batting average. 99% of everything they've ever made a darn good instrument. But even Hewlett-Packard made a clunker. Tektronix, when it comes to oscilloscopes, they make some extremely good oscilloscopes. But their spectrum analyzers are not quite as good, the plug-in spectrum analyzers, because the philosophy of making it so compact and squeezing it into the plug-in module for an oscilloscope is a tough way to go. But they've made some good ones. Let's see what Glenn's got to say. Glenn, what's your favorite spectrum analyzer? And I'll bet you own one. KC2QIQ, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, actually, Dick, I have a couple of them, but I guess the main thing I wanted to talk about tonight was the Signal Hound. This is a very, very interesting device. I have one of these, and this is something that a very serious ham radio operator, it's a must-have. It comes with software, but it allows you an open source where you can actually go in and modify the software and make it do whatever you want. Let me give you an example. One of the things that's really interesting is, you know, I do a lot of power supply engineering, and I want to measure EMI with an LISN, a line impedance stabilization network. And the problem is the calibration of that LISN has to be plugged into a spectrum analyzer in order to get the right frequency response. This allows you to do that. It has a tremendous amount of availability. It will scan all the way down to 150 kilohertz. You can set almost every rate you want independently. Let me let this reset for a second. It will allow you to do satellite work up to 4.4 gigahertz. There's software for doing satellite work. It's basically a software-defined radio. If you want to play through the speakers, radio broadcasts and tune in on things and you know, differentiate between AM and FM signals. This thing is remarkable. Would I call it a lab quality unit? No. It's a little device that's about the size of a pack of cigarettes that plugs into a USB port into your laptop. It's got two ports to it, and it's an amazing device, Dick. I can't say enough about it. I'd be on here all night talking about it. It's really remarkable. And it will fit within one of the pockets of your laptop, so it's something you can carry around with you everywhere. K2RIW, KC2QIQ. I guess you kind of figured out I like this part.
Yeah, that Signal Hound goes up to what frequency? I think Mel told us, but I didn't write that one down. Over to you, Glenn.
4.4 gigahertz, Dick.
Yeah, that's what he told us. Sounds awfully good. Sounds like a lot for the money. Okay, so spectrum analyzers, network analyzers, that's one of the main and waveform generators, one of the main subjects of discussion tonight. Let's see if we've got, I think Greg has gotten about as much information we can give him for the time being. I'm going to turn it back to Greg for a final. KC2, Yankee, India, Juliet. K2RIW, you've got it, Greg.
Thank you very much, KC2YIJ. Guys, I really appreciated the plethora of information that I have received. The Signal Hound, the standalone, the Hewlett Packard. In sum, I was to sit here and learn the controls, read the manual of my service monitor, and I'm sure that everything that we spoke about tonight, tone generator, PL, DPL, everything is incorporated in the service monitor. And for what I needed to do, I think that's more than enough. So I want to thank you very much. I appreciate it. This is KC2YIJ. I know there's a lot of people on the air that wait to get on the comments. So I'm going to say 73s. I'm still going to be on the air, but I'm going to be 73s on your final. And I really appreciate the information. KC2YIJ. Thank you very much.
WS2N for a space report if you have time, Dick.
We do just about now. Okay, sounds like Greg's a happy camper. And Mel, we're going to have to send him a bill. That was a joke. Go ahead, Paul, WS2N. What's going on in space?
Okay, just two topics. One is a Japanese
spacecraft that has returned to the to Earth, and it was called a Hayabusa, which translates to Falcon. I remember discussing this back in 2003 when it was launched, but it has returned. Its mission was to go out to an asteroid, land on an asteroid, pick up dust, tried to pick up a rock, but that failed. But it did pick up dust, or they believe it did. And then all these years later, it returned. It was supposed to come back 3 years ago, but due to complications and problems with the spacecraft, it was a little on the late side. But it has returned. It burnt up in the atmosphere above Australia. But before it did, it released a canister about 7 inches by 14 inches. They give it in centimeters, but it's about 7 by 14. And they're going to recover that and bring it back to their clean lab to try to evaluate the contents. Let me drop it. Okay, and a lot of people say, well, wow, they're way ahead. You know, they've landed on an asteroid. Well, they did, and they managed to bring something back, what they believe might be dust inside this canister. But it has been done before as far as landing on an asteroid. We have done it. We did it back in 01 with the Near spacecraft. It went to an asteroid called Eros. And that was not designed to land on an asteroid. It was designed to go there, rendezvous, and take all kinds of readings, magnetometers, and pictures, and which it did. I mean, in fact, before that, it went to another asteroid called Matilda, and did the same thing. But it didn't orbit that one, but it did orbit Eros. And the engineers made a final decision to try to soft land this thing on the asteroid, which they did. It wasn't even designed for it. So we did do that back in 01. So I wanted to just to make that point about our mission versus Japan. Although they are now like really one step ahead by bringing something back, or hopefully they did. One other topic I wanted to bring up is this radio telescope in the Netherlands. Let me drop it. They claim it's the largest radio telescope in the world, which is really true, but it's not one singular piece. It's not like the big dish in Arecibo, Puerto Rico, which is, I believe, around 1,000 feet across in diameter. But this one equivalent, it's 600 miles in diameter. It's all done through interferometry and computers and all, but they call it the low-frequency array. And to do this, they set up some 25,000 receiving antennas. 25,000. I mean, each one is, no bigger than 2 meters, but, most of them are smaller than that. And they're interconnected. And this thing should be able to look back, right to the Big Bang, or probably close to it. They've already got results as far as some kind of pictures back, which I believe was released yesterday. It's so big that, the equivalency of it's so big. It's spread across Germany and Sweden and France, I believe, Britain. And they collect all the information just like one big 600-foot diameter antenna dish. So I thought I'd bring that up. It's a big radio telescope based in the Netherlands. So that's pretty much it, Dick. I don't have any manned flight data right now, except the last flight will be in September for the space shuttle. Back to you, that, Dick. WS-20.
The low-frequency array stationed in the Netherlands, do you happen to know approximately what frequency it's operating at? Paul, go ahead.
Probably a hydrogen frequency, 1.42 gigahertz or something in that area. I believe that's it. But I searched for further information regarding that. I thought I'd come up with a frequency. But my guess is that's probably what they're looking at. You know, that's the hydrogen frequency, similar to any of the radio telescopes. They like to look at that one particular one. They feel that's the quietest, with the least amount of noise from the background radiation that would be best received. I don't know. I mean, for communication purposes, I know they would probably use that. But my guess is they're probably in that area. But I did search for it. I can't come up with a thing.
How did you come upon the information about the Netherlands low-frequency array? And do they show you a picture of any portion of the antenna? Over to you, Paul.
Now, this is one of these things that, you know, it comes up on a computer, one of the sites. Drudge Report had one little piece on it. I started with that. And then I thought I'd search further. And I got, you know, a few pieces of information. But, you know, it's one of these things that haven't really been advertised. It's, you know, it's not a massive construction piece of equipment like Arecibo, so I don't think something like this is really headline news. But what is, you know, what should be headline news is the ability to connect all these antennas and the computer power that must be involved to do with 25,000 different antennas.
That sure is a lot. Do you have any idea, Paul, how long has been in operation?
Yeah, the first day was yesterday. I wrote down the time somewhere. I don't know where I put that. But yesterday was the first release of a picture from it. And even the picture, I couldn't get any real details about what part of the sky I was looking at. It's up and running now, though.
Earlier, I think you said that the last space shuttle flight is in September. Does that mean there's only one more flight, or is there another one in between? How about you, Paul?
You have one more supply mission going up. And then the final one. And when I'm talking about supplies, I mean, they're bringing up gigantic tanks, all kinds of reserves, things that normally wouldn't be brought up or couldn't be brought up by any other equipment. And in fact, a robotic arm, I think, is involved on the next flight. You know, in case the Canada robot arm number two failed or something, they'd have a backup. Number two is the one that's attached to the International Space Station. Number one is the one that they use in the space shuttle. There's other robotic arms on board the space station. You know, there's one on the Kaibo setup. That's the two-piece section that was brought up. Two different space shuttles there. Like two gigantic rooms interconnected. Built by the Japanese, and that's one of an outdoor porch. And attached to it is one robotic arm to, you know, move all these canisters and experiments around that are outside the Kaibo research facility. I mean, you know, but that's not a big long arm, you know. That's not a big thing like the Canada arm, too. It doesn't have the mobility to inchworm its way around the space station like Canada arm, does. Russians also have an arm functioning cargo block, the first one that was ever put up. They have an arm. And then you've got there's a robot up there, the big 10-foot thing with arms coming out of it. And that could be attached to the end of the Canadian robot arm to do, you know, really work that astronauts could be done, you know, to do. It's got, I don't know how many different hands and joints and shoulder movements on that thing. Dexter, they call that. D-X-T-R-A, I think it is. Dexter. The robot's name. As far as something that actually walks around on the outside of the space station, there's really only one of them, and then they'll have a backup in case that fails, from what I understand. Things like that, big oxygen tanks, ammonia tanks, big ammonia tanks, nitrogen tanks, they'll be brought up in the next couple of flights as well. You know, the batteries, gigantic batteries, I mean, each battery is dropping. WS2NFRD, each battery is, you know, huge, 3 foot by 2 foot, you know, there's dozens of the most, you know, spaces put on the space station. Between the Russians and the United States, they have them attached to what they call the Z-1 truss structure, which is attached to one of the main trusses that connect the original connection between Unity node and the rest of the space station. Whole series of batteries in there. So these things are not, you know, they're so heavy and all, they're not normally brought up by a Progress cargo supply ship or an ATV, automatic transfer vehicle, or another supply ship. That's the one that carries about three times the amount of cargo than the Progress. That's built by the European Space Agency. It's flown a couple of times, I believe. There's more to come. That'll be going up probably every 6 months in the future. So that's pretty much it. Can't think of anything else. Hopefully the private industry picks up. You know, there is many companies, from what I see, that are going to be involved with either future manned missions or resupply missions. There's companies called SpaceX. You know, they plan on actually launching from Florida. Orbital Science Corporation plans on launching satellites. Scale Composites. That's the one that. Well, that one I don't think will ever be used for resupplying the International Space Station. That's the one that they're using. You know, you're going to see that probably in the near future. You're going to see six people boarding that thing that are paying $200,000 a piece to fly to suborbital missions, you know. And I guess eventually orbital missions. But there's a bunch of them that are out there, and hopefully, you know, they'll pick up the slack. I mean, I think they're a ways away. So it's unfortunate that they dropped the Constellation program. So we're going to have to rely on the Russians, I think, for quite a few years there. WS2.
Yeah, I'm having a lot of trouble believing that any of these private companies are going to come close to anything like a space shuttle. Space shuttle is, I guess, in 2002, it's something like $2 billion. I don't think a private company is going to come up with that. So therefore, that kind of lift capability is not going to exist anymore. And current status of the United States having any kind of a shuttle replacement. I think that program has been canceled, and I suspect that reusable vehicles are not in the American arsenal anymore. We've only got one-time use vehicles. Is that approximately true? Paul, go ahead.
Yeah, we rely on the Delta II for, you know, interplanetary missions. One that went to Mercury, they call that Messenger. That Delta II goes back. I mean, even the Mir spacecraft, the one I mentioned that we launched to an asteroid Eros and Matilda, that was back in 01. We've been relying on Delta II for those type of flights. Our heavy lift vehicle used to be the Titan 4 they would put up a lot of geosynchronous satellites, the TROs, quite a few of them for communication purposes, especially with the shuttle and with the Hubble and all of that. Your heavy lift vehicle was always the Titan 4. Now that's been replaced by the Atlas V. So, Atlas V would, it has the capability if they design a manned, spacecraft around it to put people into space. Hopefully, that's what they'll do something like that. Use the Atlas V. If they're going to abandon this whole Constellation program, they really got to put, half a dozen people on each spacecraft. That was the plan. Put it onto something similar to one of the solid boosters on the space shuttle. On top of that, you'd have a liquid-fueled rocket with people in it for the second stage. That's...
Repeater, time out. Repeater, time out. Cancel.
With a couple of people on top. That's all gone out the window. So, if they design an Orion-type spacecraft, which is what they've already put a couple of $1 billion into that already, I don't think it would be too much trouble to adapt it to the heavy lift vehicle of the Atlas V. So, I'd like to see them do something like that. And then at least you can bring people, shuttle them back and forth to the space station instead of relying just on one country, Russia. Back to you, Dave.
Okay, thank you, Paul. And interesting to see what Japan finds when they open up that canister. I think we've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. I'm going to give one more call for Vic, WE2 Alpha Romeo Quebec. Are you there, Vic? K2RIW. Okay. Is there anyone else? Have we gone down the whole list? Did I forget anyone? K2RIW, TechNet, we're listening. It's actually possible we might end a little early tonight instead of all these late nights, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
This is K2KEY. You want to take one question that I have somebody I promised to discuss it for them over.
You got it.
Okay. A recent ham invention. Guy was selling all kinds of parts from beans. He had booms, elements, traps, you name it. All different ones, pieces of pieces if you want to build your own antenna. And this one fellow, he bought a driven element for a tri-band beam, 10, 15, 20 meters. And he asked me, posed me, I said, okay, I'll bring it up on the tech net. He said, if I take this thing home, can I use it as a rotary dipole, or can I turn it and use it as a vertical, as is, a driven element off a tri-band beam, Vic? What do you think? What is the chances that's going to work well? K2RIW, this is K2KEY. Go ahead.
with one slight catch. I say it has to work well. A Yagi antenna consists of a driven element and some number of so-called parasitic elements, a reflector, a director, multiple directors. The dipole itself has to radiate in a dipole-like manner and give you a good impedance match to your transmission line at each one of the frequencies it works on. If I took the driven element out of a Yagi and throw away all of the parasitic elements, I'm going to get a slight change of the impedance of the dipole. The presence of the parasitic elements does make a slight impedance change. But if I've got an antenna tuner in the shack, which can restore that impedance, as far as the transmitter is concerned, you're back in operation. So as I see it, it has no choice but to work. It had to radiate in a dipole-like manner when it's inside of the Yagi. Therefore, it's got to radiate in a dipole-like manner outside of the Yagi. And except for that slight impedance change, it's got to go. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, years ago they used to sell driven elements. They, you know, put together your old beam and start out with a rotary dipole, and then you could add, they used to have all these different options. You buy a boom, you can buy a reflector, you can buy a directors, and all kinds of things. So I guess it's based on that. Well, okay, question. What happens to this tri-band driven element when you turn it from horizontal, which I guess it was designed for, into a vertical? In other words, do you have to add any radials? What are you really doing? Is it going to become now a really just a vertical dipole radiator? Over.
I think it has to, Mel. A horizontal dipole, by definition, radiates a horizontally polarized pattern with that characteristic figure eight when you make a polar plot of its pattern. It's got a front-to-back ratio of 0 dB and a front-to-side ratio of some very high number of dB, probably 20 dB of front-to-side ratio. Assuming you've got enough real estate, enough mounting structure, that you can hold this driven element vertical with the bottom half of it far enough away from ground, then it's got to work as a vertical center-fed half-wave dipole. Now, I'll admit that if you mount this on a tower, and if you mount it right at the top of the tower, let me drop, half of the dipole is parallel to the steel of the tower, and the other half is above the tower. And that's going to make a slight non-symmetry of the pattern. And therefore, the pattern might end up slightly tilted above or below the horizon, but I don't think it's going to be very much. To work well, you may have to offset it from the tower a few feet. But if you've got the wherewithal to mount that vertically polarized, without the bottom of it coming too close to a whole lot of other hardware, and what's too close? If the bottom of the vertical dipole is more than a couple of feet away from other substantial metallic or dielectric objects, then I think there's going to be very little non-symmetry, and I think it's got to go. Mechanically, it may be a little bit more difficult to feed a center-fed, vertically polarized dipole, but in theory, it's got to work, and I don't see how it can stop working, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, we're up a very interesting question. As far as how far off ground would the tip of this driven element have to be if it's in a vertical position? In other words, we stuck it into a 10-foot length of PVC pipe to support it, because, you know, it can't be supported on the tip in any way. In other words, mechanically, you've got a little bit of a problem here. unless you can figure out some way of supporting it in the middle, you know, where the boom was, some way coming off there on an angle. But let's say that if you stuck it in a piece of PVC pipe, 10-foot length, would that be sufficient? Over.
That's one possible way. When the dipole was part of the Yagi, it was parallel to the ground, and it was strapped down to the boom of the Yagi. I can think various ways I could strap it to a small L-shaped piece of tubing and mount it into the top of a tower. So whether you support it from the center or support it from the bottom by way of an insulating material, those are your choices. And yes, it's a little bit more difficult to support it from the center and feed it from the center. You've also got to bring a transmission line up to that center. But if this thing was, let's see now, 20 meters is, a 32-foot length for half wave. So therefore, this dipole is in the vicinity of 32 feet long, 33 feet long. Therefore, the center is 16 feet away from the tip. If you can mount the center 25 feet above the ground, I think you can make it fly. Back to you, Mel, K2RIW.
KC2, QIQ, with some questions and a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, I pretty much have mentioned it before that I do have a shortened beam, you know, multi-band and multi-element, basically in Yagi, and I twist it between horizontal to vertical all the time. And what I found is that the amount of detuning from going from horizontal to vertical is almost immeasurable. It's very, very little. It's mainly because the directing element, powered element, is basically tuned. So, in other words, it's like a half-wave dipole sitting up there balanced on both ends. So the tower itself or the mast, whether it's steel or PVC, which would be a poor choice because it's just too flexible to hold that mass, it really doesn't see a dick. It's almost invisible to the antenna. It's interesting how that works, but it basically does. Let it drop for a second. My other question for you, aside from that, that's just, you know, pure experience with my MA-5B going from vertical to horizontal, was the, do you have general dimensions for like a monoband Yagi? If you were just going to take a directing element and you're going to create a reflecting and a director, are there some like known dimensions like for, if you wanted to create one, like scaling measurements, like for distance along the boom and length of the reflecting and driven elements? K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Oh, absolutely. There are. But your next question is, where? I'm sure there's a number of websites. I'm sure there's been a number of articles in ham radio and QST and whatever. And bear in mind that if, for instance, you had a three-element Yagi and you want to make it a six-element Yagi, common sense would say, okay, I add three more directors. Not quite that simple. Those directors constitute a kind of a magnifying glass. It has the equivalent of a focal length. It's got a certain effective capture area, and it tries to focus that signal down onto the driven element. As you make that Yagi longer, you want to make the director string have a longer focal length. That means if you're a purist, all of the previous directors have to be readjusted in length when you add more directors. Lots of people have just simply slapped on more directors, and pretty soon the antenna stopped increasing in gain and started decreasing in gain, and that made a bunch of people come out with theories saying that, beyond X number of elements, the Yagi runs out of steam. Not true at all. There are 102 element Yagis on one single boom, as long as all those directors are the same length. So, there are formulas, and there are Vizbicki is one of them. He's got a set of rather well-respected formulas for various length Yagis. That was a, let me drop. This Bicky was a technical report from the National Bureau of Standards. That's where he worked when he did that work. Gunter Hock, DL6WU, Delta Lima 6 Whiskey Uniform. He's got a bunch of articles on well-tuned Yagis of various lengths. So it's more than just slapping on more elements. Wanted to make some sense of Greg, I mean Glenn. Back to you, Glenn.
Yes, it definitely does. I mean, I know there's a lot of software programs out there that do this and everything else, but and I understand the basic theory. We've talked about it before, you know, looking at the, you know, the wavelength and the delay of the signal as it's moving forward. I was just wondering if there was any known stuff, but I think I'm going to start with the Gunter Hock stuff and research that a little bit more. But thanks for the info, Dick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Very interesting. You know, it's funny, we have never seen any verticals come on a market that, based on this principle, in other words, 10, 15, and 20-meter trap vertical usually is a antenna with the trap vertical quarter wavelength, whatever, for the first section, 10 meters, let's say, and then has a couple of traps, 15, or maybe 20 meters, and then they'll show, you know, a number of radials. We'd be better off in a situation to say that duplicate the other half of the antenna as in a beam as this driven element and make it a vertical that instead of going to the radial situation, go back to the traps, take over.
In the case of a quarter wave electronic radiator, where the mirror image in the ground is created by the counterpoise, those ground plane radials, there's never enough ground plane radials. You're trying to create a perfect mirror image of the other half of the dipole. A smart guy realizes he can use a lot less aluminum and a lot less wind load if he's got the real estate to mount a vertical dipole to make a real half-wave vertical dipole. You're way ahead of the game. Much higher in performance, higher center of radiation, no requirement for ground plane radials of any kind. I'm very unhappy about the fact that a pure vertical half-wave radiator is so unpopular. It's a little bit more difficult as far as the total amount of vertical length is concerned, but I think it's an extremely good investment that's going to pay off. Now back to you, Mel.
Exactly. You know, I've never seen anything in the handbook, the antenna book, or anything like that suggestion that take the dipole. You've seen dipoles in a number of configurations, you know, making them slopers, making them in an inverted V configuration. But for some reason, they have never showed a dipole hanging from a point. You know, you would think that they showed different types of verticals, such as ground plates and trees and all, but never showed one suspended in a pure vertical. In other words, just took that dipole and made it, as you say, into a pure halfway vertical. I can't see why it should be any problem on, say, 10 meters or even 15 meters, even... let's say 20 meters, I think it's still doable because it's within reasonable heights, Dick. Yet, why has it never been really mentioned, really? I don't think I've ever seen any reference to it, if I'm not mistaken, over.
The closest I can think of, there's been a couple of articles about hanging a vertical, essentially half-wave radiator, and feeding it in a J-pole manner from the bottom. There's nothing magic about feeding it in the center. With the right kind of impedance matching network, and that's what J-pole does for you, you can feed it from the bottom. I've got enough tower to do that, and I'm very tempted. I've been talking to you about that for some time. As soon as I get out from under a couple of higher priorities I've got right now, I want to make an experiment of an 80-meter, purely vertical, half-wave dipole set at the bottom. I've got a pulley up there and a piece of rope going around it, ready to haul it up in the air, Mel. And there's a slim chance that could be a rock crusher of an antenna with very little hardware. You probably almost have enough wherewithal to do that, too. And there's nothing magic about making it purely vertical. A sloper would do very nicely. K2KEY, K2LIW.
N2MB, I'm doing it now.
Give us a couple of words about how you did it, how well it works, and how long you've been doing it. N2 Moon Bounce, K2LIW. Go ahead, Barry, and wait for the beep.
It's the beep? Okay, yeah. I've been doing it for about a year, year and a half. I think you know that. And I got to shut off the computer. I've got a computer running in the background, so you can probably hear it. Come on, please, Jack, get out of here. There you go. I just did pretty much what you said. I took a dipole, vertical dipole, and I cranked it up my tower. And because I have antennas on the top of my tower, it would have extended out the top, and it would have gotten involved with the antennas. So what I did to overcome that is I made it into a little bit of an inverted V kind of thing. You know, I pulled it away from the tower a little bit, about 10 feet, 15 feet. That shortened the thing enough so that it was like a V shape, and I could stretch this thing out in my backyard. It also got it away from the tower, which was very convenient. And it works great. I work a ton of DX, and I switch from that to a horizontal dipole, and the difference is very striking. It turns out that Europe, and mostly Europe, and you know, over the pole into Russia, and things that work much better on the vertical. I think parts of Africa are like that too, but domestically, from California all the way back to New York, for some reason, most of the time it works better on the horizontal antenna. So that's the result, and it works great.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, I think what's happening there is that when you find out really a lot of the big stalk stations and a lot of stations here in the U.S., a lot of people, are, especially the higher power stations, are using, you know, horizontally polarized antennas. They're using a lot of periodics, step IRs, you know, a lot of multi-element monoband beams, all horizontally polarized. And you find the same thing even in Europe, that some of them over there will use that. But when you want to go to some other areas, you know, vertical performance will definitely work for you. But I've tried the vertical dipole, and I mean, it works okay. It's not bad. It's just so darn difficult to hold it up there. The amount of supporting structure that you need, unless you've got an ideal kind of tree to hang it, it's not that easy to do. And chances are, if you have a tower, more than likely you're going to put a step IR or a big Mosley or something up on the top of it to do the job. Just my general experience. And the other thing, too, is if you have a single point tower, what I've found is that even better than the vertically hung dipoles, the inverted V seems to be the better bet. I've always seemed to have better performance out of an inverted V from a very high point up on the top, and basically just balance the antenna on both sides, and it seems to really work phenomenally over just a purely, you know, vertically hung dipole. Back to you, Dick. That's just my experience, though. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, let me grab that for a second, Dick.
You got it, Barry.
Yeah, I should have qualified that. I made a mistake. This whole thing is on 75 meters. I'm not doing this on 20 and 10 and 15 and all those things. I should. I do use the vertical dipole, I guess you call it, on 20 meters and things like that. I have to, you know, retune it, and I'm feeding it with coax, so sometimes retuning it can be a little bit of a problem, but I really haven't played around with that, and I'm not taking that very seriously. Everything I just told you, though, is for 75 meters, pretty much like 3,800 around there. So I don't know what kind of results I really would get if I did this seriously for like 20 meters. I haven't even tried that.
What's the amount of detuning that you believe Rich N2EO's helo on 6 meters required? Was he tuned a little bit out of his desirable portion of the band, and you had to do a rechecking of that top side? Is that what happened this week? Barry, go ahead.
No, I just put it up wrong. I made a mistake. He's got a gamma match on that thing, and I don't know why I did that. Instead of, they have a shorting bar on the outside of the gamma match, and they have a little sleeve that affects the capacitance. I moved the capacitance sleeve instead of the shorting bar. I wasn't following the instructions. I managed to tune it pretty good that way, but that's really not the way to do it. It's not, the capacitance, they pretty much figure on, you don't want to change that. They want you to move the shorting bar. So when I moved the shorting bar, everything worked fine. It was just my stupidity.
Yeah, he was unhappy about the fact that on 6 meters he expected to hear a lot of pops and clicks, and for a while he wasn't. You have reason to believe now he's up to essentially full 6 meter sensitivity?
I think he was before. I don't think any of that's changed. I don't think the performance of the antenna changed one bit, actually. I doubt it. He just needed a preamp. He's got a 40-year-old radio there, and it's just not all that sensitive on 6 meters. But I think the amount of improvement he got from putting the preamp on would be difficult to measure. Personal feeling. I think he was getting all of that stuff, just didn't realize it.
When he added the preamp, his sensitivity went down better than 0.05 microvolt. And before he added the preamp, the sensitivity was 0.5 microvolt. That's a 20.0 decibel difference. So adding the preamp, when measured with a WaveTech service monitor, made a 20 dB improvement in the sensitivity of that Heathkit SB110A. Back to you, Barry.
Yeah, but I'm sure you realize that on 6 meters, unless you're looking up at something like cold sky, which he's not doing, all you're going to hear is power line static, car static, I don't know why. You know, there's just so much noise on 6 meters that a half a microvolt is plenty, you know?
He told me that without the preamp, even with the preamp, his S meter reads S0, and when he connects the antenna, the S meter goes up to S3 with the preamp. So I'm confirming what you're saying. You're saying the background noise, sky noise as well as man-made noise on 6 meters, is quite significant. And on that particular band, a half dB noise figure is not really required. Do you have any of the details of how his preamp at first was being fed the wrong voltage? Over to you, Barry.
No, I really know. I don't. I never asked him how he was powering that preamp. I never even thought to ask him that. And I understand he was powering it from the wrong place in that old Heathkit radio. Now he's taking and he's rectifying some filament voltage. I guess the thing uses 12-volt filaments, I suppose. So he's rectifying the filament voltage, which is a better way to get your 12-volt DC power supply for that thing.
It sure is, except that the 12.6 volts with a full-wave rectifier, or even a half-wave rectifier, but a peak rectifier into a capacitor, is giving him 17 volts. And he's a little worried that the preamp, which doesn't have a built-in voltage regulator, maybe is not going to be happy with 17 volts. I don't think he's got to worry about it. If the noise figure degrades a tiny bit, you have to have a mountain of a noise figure to be bad on 6 meters, and the extra voltage, if anything, is going to give him a higher intercept point. What do you think?
I agree with you 100%, but if it really, I didn't really know that was, he was getting a higher voltage than he should. But, you know, that's easy to fix. You put some diodes in series with the DC voltage and you cut it down. You know, that works quick.
Yeah, since he's got a fixed load of a preamp, all he's got to do is put a series resistor between the 12.6 volt filament and his rectifier network. The right series resistor will be a very low power version of lowering the voltage. It won't have great voltage regulation, but he doesn't need it. That preamp, if he slid from 11 volts to 13 volts on that preamp, except for the 1 dB increase in gain, he'd never know anything happened. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with you. I think you and I both have played around with preamps a lot in our lives, and it matters when you go to 432 and 1296, and even on 2 meters. You can realize an advantage putting a preamp front of your radio on 2. But on 6 meters, I don't do that, and I don't think it's necessary.
He was hearing quite a few DX stations, DX meaning, you know, Chicago and Wisconsin or whatever, on 6 meters or during the contest. He intentionally didn't do any transmitting. He just did some listening while he's doing all this tuning up. Okay. We've got 2 minutes before the end of the hour. This was TechNet number 1301, 1301, of the series that began in September of 1982. I'm starting to call this the Mel and Dick Radio School. That's what we're trying to do. And we've got a beginner course and a more advanced course, and we flip back and forth between the two. 73, you all. We'll be back next week. And be kind to each other. K2KEY, K2RAW. You got it, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. Yeah, I'm on 75 meters. Mostly groups get together that are a few within, you know, short distances, up to a couple hundred miles apart, like the group I'm involved with. So the horizontal loop that I use on 75 meters, the full wave loop, works extremely well. Not a DX antenna. I have a vertical for 80 meters for the low end where I do my CW work. Great antenna for DXing. But you need the two antennas, basically, if you want to do both on 80 meters. So that's basically the layout that I'm using right now. 73 is everybody. Like Dick says, we'll try to do it again next week. Have a great week, and take care. This is K2KEY saying good morning.
Mel, one of these days I got to talk to you about directional antennas for 75 meters, you know, those little loops and things you make. I really got to talk to you about that in 2MB.
Hey, anytime you got a chance, possibly get to talk about this, Barry. I know we've talked about it briefly a number of times. Very fascinating, but loops and whole story in themselves, the whole antenna situation that's completely different from, you know, other antenna situations. Okay, with that, yeah, got to get to work in the morning, so 73.
Hey, Mel, WS2N.
Well,
you have a favorite location on 80 meters where I could ever find you, or I know a while back you did, but did you find a new one?
So we sort of got into a little bit of problems with some of the people up there that we were that had joined our group. We originally had a nice, neat little group and very friendly, and then things just got a little bit out of hand, and certain things that were not called for, innuendos, things that were somewhat personal nature, especially to me, and out of the realm of ham radio, basically. So we gave up there and moved to 3.710. Call over.
Okay, very good. I'll probably be on that on definitely Tuesday night. My son-in-law is coming over. He's a relative new hand, you know, maybe half a year. Oh, very good. I was just talking with a couple of guys before the net on 3.
So what are your hours on 3710?
We usually get on around 11:30 at night, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, but we've been sort of missing a lot of this lately. I come home a little too tired, or the other guys that go out fishing, they're big fishermen, so during the winter time, we've been consistently on from 11:30 to about 12:30, Barry, over.
Okay, I just wrote it down. I know I ran into you, I think, on 10 meters the other day.
Yeah, well, it's Sunday morning. We have the group on starting at 11 o'clock on 28.380. 28.380, 10 meter group. It's a mini, sometimes We try to keep it light, but many times it winds up as a mini tech net.